Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest episode of the Footmarks podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And it's a very interesting topic today for this Footmarks. It's called 19th century batting. Of course, it is inspired by the opening chapter of Jared's book, The Art of Batting. We got two arts of batting right here on the screen. And you guys should order your copy today. And it's funny how when Jared released Overthrowing Cricket's Empire, we did like at least 4 to 5 podcasts from that book. And this is no different. Of course, this is inspired by The Art of Batting. And Jared, I just want to go back to October 2022. I was visiting England and I was going on all of these tours to Lords, Wimbledon, the Oval. And when I visited the Oval, I went to the Surrey Museum. I think I've told you the story. And my brother was with me. And we entered that tiny ass museum, you know, inside the Oval. And I saw that bat from the old days, right? It looks like a hockey stick. You're thinking, how the hell is this a cricket bat? I'm guessing it's from some point in the mid-19th century or something. And it looked that way like a hockey stick because underarm bowling was all the rage in cricket back in that day. And I suppose we've come a long way since then, haven't we, as far as the evolution of batting is concerned?
Yeah, I so many people like you see it for the first time and freak out. I remember a professional cricketer, and I can't remember who it was, but it was someone, reasonably well-known, sending me a message going, can you explain to me why this bat looks like this? And and people just don't understand the full history of the game. But no, you're right. There was a time at which it made more sense to have a bat where the majority of the wood was at the bottom because balls were being rolled along the ground. And even underarm balls weren't bouncing particularly high. Like the balls weren't coming off the surface all that much. So it really was much more like hockey from that perspective. You know, you're not that you're trapping the ball like hockey, but that you're striking the ball like a hockey player would when they're, you know, going for goal. So it's very, very different from that perspective. And it tells you that the game as it was, I would say the game as we know it really isn't born until the 1860s. So before that, we're really looking at almost a completely, an entirely different sport.
That's true. And I mean, you guys should go and take a look at that picture off the bat. I probably have it somewhere in my archives as well. So if you want to go and stalk me on Instagram, you can find it. But anyway, so pre-1860s, we have underarm bowling en masse, right? And then before we actually get to overarm bowling, Jared, we have roundarm bowling, right? Which is delivered from shoulder length. And then slowly and gradually we kind of, or cricket kind of moves towards overarm bowling. So like how quick was the transition from roundarm to overarm? Because I know that underarm to roundarm took an eternity, right? But I feel like the roundarm era is not that long.
No, so roundarm probably, when we first start talking about overarm bowling, we're not really meaning overarm bowling, we're meaning roundarm. So I think the first guys started bowling from their hip, and then it just keeps coming up to probably your rib cage and then eventually to your shoulder. And then overarm bowling is probably, we need Abhishek Mukherjee here, but I think overarm bowling becomes more of a thing probably late 1840s, early 1950s. And then that takes over roundarm bowling because it's much more accurate and also because of the bounce, right? The unpredictability of the bounce and everything else. So, yeah, you probably have a period where I think there was quite a few. I don't think we had test roundarm bowlers outside of batters who bowled, right? I would say the vast, by the time we get to test cricket in the 1870s, I think the vast majority of bowlers who are specialist bowlers are overarm, what we would say sort of more traditional, you know, modern day bowling.
Yeah.
But there were some people who hung around with the sidearm bowling for longer.
Interesting. But anyway, in that underarm bowling era, which is pre-1860s, so early to mid days of the 19th century, right? Cricket, or batting, in fact, was all about survival. You weren't really scoring a lot of runs. You were deciding whether you were a front foot batter or a back foot batter, and you wouldn't be both. W.G. Grace, of course, goes on to change that. But I just want to throw out some names over here, which I've been absolutely fascinated with. One of the names is what Varun brought up before we started recording, Fuller Pilch. Pre-W.G. Grace, he is the most successful batter in history. He averages 18.6 with the bat. 18.6 runs per innings, right? Now that paints a picture.
So Most successful batter, how many first class hundreds?
Three first class hundreds and over 7,000 first class runs. So the sample size is massive, right? For Fuller Pilch. But then you've got Nicholas Felix, who averages 18.1 with the bat. And you also listed down Alfred Min, who is averaging 13.4. Now, just for my own curiosity, I know of two players from that era as well, which I think they were all-rounders. Maybe that's why they missed out on the chapter. The Johns, John Wisden and John Lillywhite, right? So those guys averaged in the mid-teens as well. I think Wisden averaged around 14 and Lillywhite averaged around 17. But are these guys like more coinciding with the period of W.G. Grace, or are they also from Pilch's era?
John Wisden plays, he makes his debut, I'm just looking it up now, he starts in 1845 and finishes in 1863. So he's got a better batting average, but remember, by 1863, Grace exists.
True.
Right? So by that stage, there are more runs. Grace doesn't invent the more runs. The more runs are happening naturally as we understand how to curate wickets and everything else. Whereas if you look at Fuller Pilch, he starts in 1820 and finishes, 25 years after, he starts 25 years before John Wisden does. So John Wisden is known more as an all-rounder who could bat, whereas Fuller Pilch was the dominant batter of the 1820s and 30s and probably maybe even 1840s. He was still pretty dominant. So some of Wisden's numbers would probably be, I don't have the ability to go in right now and check if he was better at the back end of his career with a bat, but my assumption would be that his batting average probably would have slowly risen over time, just before eventually it dropped off a little bit when he got old.
What about Lillywhite?
Lillywhite was an all-rounder too, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he averaged around 17 and a half with the bat, right? Which is very, very healthy, especially if he's an all-rounder.
He also, I don't know if you've ever been to London, but you'll see the Lillywhite sports stores.
I'm
pretty sure that's from his family. No, Lillywhite is 1862. That's the next generation again. So again, I think he was an all-rounder, wasn't he, Lillywhite? Let's just have a look at his record here.
Pretty sure he was.
Yeah. So he was an all-rounder as well. I think he was left-arm. He's one of the first famous left-armers, but...
Also,
he batted left-handed as well.
He's averaging, 11 with the ball, which is shit for his era, right?
It's probably okay for his era, I think. There's two Lillywhites. Which one are you looking at?
I have no idea. I did go down a rabbit hole. Because I just remember John Wisden we know because of the Wisden Cricketers Almanac. But Lillywhite, you have mentioned to me like three times.
There's a couple of Lillywhites. But yeah, they're more, again, they're that later generation. Whereas if you look at Alfred Min, where are we here? I'm just trying to get all the years in my head. You can tell, the best way of telling is, are there photos of these guys or are there portraits? And if there are portraits, it's probably because of when they played. So Alfred Min, he makes his debut in 1832. So again, that's 13 years before John Wisden makes his debut, right? And some of these guys are not just famous, though, for their talent. Nicholas Felix on the bat, he's famous for the book he wrote about batting, which becomes kind of the first coaching manual, I suppose. Was Alfred Min involved with pads? Was he the first guy?
Wasn't it Arthur Shrewsbury?
Yeah, but also Alfred Min, he scored 100. Yeah, he ended up, he might have been one of the first ones to wear a pad. I'm just trying to find that full information. But there was a reason he wore pads. And I think he might have worn pads because he had a problem with his leg at one stage. I can't remember. I'd have to go back through. But so they're not just famous for being great batters. Fuller Pilch is the one who's probably best known as being the great batter. But again, Alfred Min still thought of to be one of the best batters of his era, 212 matches, an average of 13 with 100.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically the point of all of this, not just because I want you guys to know the names of Fuller Pilch and Nicholas Felix and Alfred Min, but also just to kind of paint a picture how prior to W.G. Grace, these guys are averaging less than 20 runs or even less than 19 runs per innings. So it really goes on to paint a picture how difficult batting was. And I think the even more crucial bit over here to discuss is that you either had back foot players, primarily back foot players, or primarily front foot players. And then WG Grace is this first sort of cricketer who's like, all right, I'll deploy both methods based on the length of the ball. If it's a fuller length delivery, I'll play on my front foot. And if it's a back of a length or shorter delivery, I'll play it on my back foot. Now, this all may seem very rudimentary to us right now, because when you go into, you know, cricket coaching school or a club at what, 8, 9 years of age, that's one of the first things you learn. But Jared, to me, after reading the chapter especially, it seems like this little revolution by WG Grace is pretty much one of the most major inflection points in batsmanship as a craft. Batsmanship as a craft, yeah.
Yeah, it really, I think the main turning point is probably the pitches, which I know we'll come on to a little bit, but it turns it from a bowler's game to a batter's game. Right, because from that point forward, the batters can choose to attack based on the delivery, not just play their same shot over and over again. So that's essentially what people like Fuller Pilch would have been doing, right?
Yeah.
On the front foot, on the back foot, whatever their shot was, they would have played the same shot over and over again. Whereas once you bring in footwork and that ability to come forward, to come back, to get out to a wide ball, to, you know, get your front foot out of the way, all those sorts of things that we just now do naturally.
Yeah.
That then means that bowlers are under pressure from that point forward. Whereas beforehand, it really, from the averages and the records that we have, quite clearly the bowlers were on top. And if you made 100, you were probably lucky, right? Yeah. There was something probably happened that went in your favor. And that's not the case afterwards. Afterwards, you might just play brilliantly.
Yeah, so foot movement is not just an innovation. It changes batting as we know it to this day. And I feel like that's why it was really important to kind of discuss it. And that also kind of elevates WG Grace's stature in 19th century batting, of course, which he is the king of. Yeah. But anyway,
let's... Even if he just averaged the same as the next best player in that era, I think you would still say, a bit like Trumper, that he had a huge impact on the game. But in his case, he's almost combining Bradman-like numbers with Trumper-like influence or Ranji-like influence. So it's a combination of both for Grace, which is part of the reason that we still talk about him today. And he has Gates and, you know, Monty Python and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's other stuff with respect to WG Grace that probably doesn't get spoken of a lot. The misogyny, the fact that he was a bit of a cheat. But then again, he's the grandfather of cricket and he had a major impact on our sport. So that's what we're more concerned with. Anyway, let's come to what you've been wanting to come to for a bit. The muck spreader revolution, as I like to call it, of course. Now, just to give people a kind of an idea, in these early days, mid-1900s or before that, bits or little bits of manure were spreaded out on the pitch by hand. And as overarm bowling or round-arm bowling becomes more of a thing, that needs to change, because now it's super dangerous for batters, given that some deliveries will literally, you know, hit those bits of shit and jump viciously off the surface, and some would just keep low. So that meant that there needed to be a system where the surface is more level. And then they started to liquefy the manure and spreading it evenly, which is via the muck spreader. So interestingly enough, it's agriculture which brings about a major sort of turning point as far as batting is concerned.
There is an incredible history of how agriculture has been involved in cricket. Like, obviously, we have the term cow corner. We use a leather ball largely because there were cows in Sussex probably at that stage. The same for baseball. Both of those sports have leather balls based on probably just the, you know, where it was. The fact that farmers had a chain of 22 yards, right? Like all these different things that involved. But yeah, so the muck spreader, and I've done a lot of research on this over the last couple of years. Farming people will say that the actual term muck spreader now, as it is used, is slightly different to what the groundsmen were talking about at that time. But the term muck spreader was used and was talked about in, I think I found it in both MCC libraries, right? But certainly I remember the MCG library when they still had a library. I don't know if they're getting rid of it, but it was an incredible place. But I remember doing lots of research there. Getting David, who ran that library, to look into it for me. And because we were trying to track when, because England is an industrial area, right? So there's a lot of industrial stuff going on. And America is where it looks like this stuff came from. But how does it get to Hobart is my question, right?
Also, isn't it ironic that despite the muck spreader being introduced in the late 19th century, the New York pitch was still very, very shit?
It is very funny. So... I'm not sure how much it was liquefied at that point. That's the bit we don't know because there just wasn't enough written about the exact thing. But what we know is before, there were certainly big chunks of it on the pitch. And afterwards, there are certainly fine chunks of it on the pitch. So it goes from being a surface which is very hard to bat on because of how much that was happening. And as agriculture is getting to liquefying and everything else, the pitches are getting better. So we know that there is a direct correlation between farmers spreading their shit by shovel in the old days, and as you said, by hand, you know, and just getting it out there any way they can. And then by the first machines, which might have just chopped it up into fine pieces, and then eventually liquefying it. So I don't know. And so muck spreader now is a machine that chops it up into really fine pieces and then flicks it out from the back of a tractor.
Yeah.
The term as it was used then wasn't quite, and muck spreader is like, it's not even that muck spreader is the main term. I think the Wikipedia page is manure spreader, but when I read it in the old cricket stuff, it, you know, in the old newspaper reports, they were using the term muck spreader at that time. But yes, essentially we go from big chunks to small chunks to no chunks.
Yeah.
Right. And that happens over about a 40 to 50 year period from what we can tell. And by the 1890s, cricket is completely different. And if I said 1860s is when cricket becomes what we know it to be, 1890s are when pitches are what we know them to be.
Yeah.
And so at this stage, there's enough knowledge and, you know, there's some historical precedent of, you know, groundsmen sending letters to each other in different parts of the world. And, you know, we're starting to think of it as a science and a profession, whereas before you were a groundsman and it was your job to make the grass look good and the pitch would be, you would hope it was, you know, it was fine. Now there was like an art and a science to being able to being able to put cricket pitches together and everything else.
The science of muck, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so we can tell this through the averages. Yeah. We can actually see the, you know, industrial revolution, the agricultural revolution, whatever you want to call it, happen through the first class batting averages, which is wild. It's just fucking wild to me, Bayram, that we could see that happening. And to be honest, it keeps going until the 1930s, really. I think by the 1930s, we know exactly what we need to do. And that's when we have the big boom. You know, by the 1930s, you have Hammond and you have Sutcliffe and you have Bradman and you have Headley. And those guys, as great as they were, would not have been able to do that on the wickets of the 1890s or even the early 1900s. Some of them would have struggled to do that, right? It's a completely different surface that you are playing on by that point. So batting has been invented in the 1850s, 1860s in the way that we know it.
Yeah.
But the pitches just take a little bit longer to catch up. So it's just a fascinating thing. And it's not very well written on. It took me forever. I remember when I did the test cricket book, it took me so long to actually try and narrow some of this down. And there was someone who left a comment on our Discord channel the other day going, I'm not sure this is right because the term muck spreader actually means this. And it's like, yeah, I agree with you. But if you go back, that was what they were doing. So I would say that we just kept making shit finer until it didn't cause any problems to a cricket ball is the best way of looking at it.
Making shit great again. Basically. But anyway, we can agree or disagree on what the exact terminology was, whether it was muck spreader or manure spreader or whatever. But would you say, Jared, that this innovation with the spreader of shit, right, was it the biggest innovation in terms of making cricket more batting friendly in that century? Was it bigger than grace just simply existing?
Yeah, I think it probably is because as great as grace is, we're still seeing him average around 30 to 35 in a lot of years, right?
Yeah.
I know he has a couple of years where he does 50, but he doesn't have many years where he averages 70 or 78 or something like that, right? Like he doesn't have many years that, you know, what did Muhammad Yusuf average in that year when he went nuts in Test cricket?
I can't remember the average, but he scored like 1600 something runs or maybe 1700 something runs.
So I'm assuming, I mean, off the top of my head, I think Viv Richards averages something like, he averages over 100 in the year that he did it, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yusuf we might weren't have getting as well, years like because he scored some daddy hundreds. Yeah.
So I just got up Grace's numbers here. So Grace's biggest average in a year was 65, and he did another one of 62 and a couple more in the 50s. Oh, sorry. There was one year he averaged 72. So the vast majority of his years, he's averaging, you know, 39, 35, 37, 43, Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really great. These are great numbers for his era, but he's not averaging 100. Like, remember, was it Karen Nair who averaged like 200 a couple of years ago?
Mm-hmm.
We're not seeing those kinds of numbers, but yeah. We know that Grace was that level of batter, right? So that tells us that if the pitches had stayed the same, right, we probably wouldn't have got a position then where that would have happened. We probably wouldn't have changed the full element of batting in that way. So I would argue that the pitchers probably played a bigger part, and I think that Grace is just behind them with the footwork.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I suppose that's fair. You can put batting getting easy for the first time in the history of cricket, by the way, down to the muck spreader and pitches getting more level. But of course, you cannot deny the impact of W.G. Grace either. Anyway, we will be talking more about the evolution of batting in the 19th century in a bit. But before that, let us take a short break. You guys are watching Footmarks with Bairam and Jared, and we'll be back with you very shortly.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Welcome back to Footmarks. You guys are with Jared and Bairam, and we are discussing 19th century batting today. So we've already discussed the impact of, the muck spreader and W.G. Grace's batting, but there's other stuff that starts happening over here, Jared. Now, you mentioned how Alfred Min might have been the first player to wear pads because of a condition that he had. But in the underarm bowling days, protective gear wasn't really a thing. And as soon as we start seeing more round arm, overarm bowling, and the surface is getting better and the ball's finally starting to bounce a bit more, you know, protective gear becomes mainstream in batting. So there are two things. Gloves and pads probably come before anything else, I'm assuming, or maybe the box even, right? At what time?
I think the pads are first.
The pads are first. I would like to know the chronological order of how these things start getting infused into first-class cricket, and how long does it take for cricket to get to that point where it's just the norm? Everyone is wearing protective gear.
It's not that long. I think it's about 20, 25 years, and it's that period where there is underarm, overarm, and roundarm bowling coming on. So it's 1838-ish, maybe 1835. I'm sure someone had used pads before because, there's always people who try random things. But I think there's a little bit goes on around the 1830s, but it's really probably 1840s, 1850s when it becomes a thing. And then by that point, they take over. It's not as if everyone picks them up straight away. Pads are the first one. I think there's a couple of stories. I think there's a story of it might be a school game of a kid getting his leg broke. And it's a really bad break. And, I think it makes news. That starts to spread it around a little bit more. And then, of course, you got to remember that cricket is a massive sport, right? Like, football isn't really that big at this stage. Like, the Manchester sides don't exist. I think they're late 1800s, right? Yeah. Rugby is a decent level sport, but not on the level of cricket. Rugby league hasn't really even, maybe has been formed, but it's not that big. So there's a huge industry around cricket. That's why James Lillywhite and John Wisden, right? They're brands that still exist because of cricket, right?
True.
And so, I think what happens is people get to that level where once it becomes a thing of you could break your leg, you start to find that cricket pads turn up everywhere not long after that. So part of it is probably marketing and everything else. Gloves take a little bit longer, and the original gloves are not really, they're not actually gloves to protect your hand.
Yeah, there's no padding.
They're gloves to keep the grip on, right? When they first come through. And, baseballers, what do they put tar on their hands, don't they? I think that's, so baseballers were putting tar on their hands. But if you think about it, you're only holding a baseball bat for like, what, a minute, 3 or 4 minutes, whereas you would need the tar out there the whole time if you're a cricketer to keep doing that. So it probably made more sense to go to gloves. And so then gloves come through. I think, I don't know as much about the history of the box, but I'm assuming it comes through at a similar time.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time really to get to thigh pads, chest pads, arm guards and helmets. Those take a lot longer, but the pads sort of come through in a wave. and then the gloves come off the back of that. And then it's probably after, I would say it's not really till after World War II that you start getting what we would consider modern pads. Modern gloves.
Yeah. Well, it's shocking, really, that the box took longer than the pads, because you'd assume that people would be more, you know, afraid of potential injuries in that region.
You've got to think about where the ball was bouncing in those days.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Why.
That makes sense.
If you played cricket now and you could only take out one bit of protection and you're a man, you're going to take a box, right? Yeah. But that's because the balls generally come between your knee and your waist, right?
True.
But if you were playing cricket in those days, it's your shins you really want to protect, right?
Yeah.
And so that's also why, think about it, the box probably does come next, but the thigh pad, it really, I wouldn't say thigh pads are particularly good in cricket until the 80s.
The West Indian and what happened base then? Quartet is probably what brings about thigh pads.
It's that length, right? Hmm. Because up until that point, you had your shins covered, you had your balls covered, and you had your hands covered. Suddenly everyone's bowling back of a length at you. Hmm. The thigh pad is almost as important as the shin guard at that point. Like if you're anyone who's ever played proper level cricket on a good hard wicket, well, no, you can't go out there without a thigh pad because you're going to get, I would say I get hit almost as much in my thigh pad in Australia as I did on my normal pads, right? Mm. Because, you know, that length and where it's coming. So, yeah, the evolution of the sort of cricket kit is really, really interesting. And it comes from what is most important at that time. So leg pads first, and the next major innovation is probably the abdominal guard, the box, whatever you want to call it. And at that stage, the gloves aren't as important because you're not getting hit on the hands as much, right? It's as you start to get hit on the hands from body line onwards that people probably go, wait a minute, we've got to protect people's fingers.
Absolutely. But it's interesting, right? Now, you've played a lot of backyard cricket in Australia and currently with Eek. And I've played a lot of tape ball, gully cricket in Pakistan and in your backyard as well. But the point is that when we put some protective gear on, we're not only, you know, protecting ourselves, but it kind of impacts our game as well. You're batting with a bit more weight. Your follow through is a bit different. So these, you know, little introductions in terms of protective gear, like pads and the box, they also kind of revolutionize the craft in different ways, the way you kind of move around with your body. Yeah. And also there's the Arthur Shrewsbury story, who kind of makes that disruption of padding balls away, which are on the leg side.
Yeah, exactly. Padding balls away when they're outside off stump as well, I think. Mm. Like anything not on the stumps, he kind of did that. And so pads first come in as a line of defense because you don't want to have a broken leg, right?
True.
That, as we just said, that's exactly why they have come in. Hmm. Grace has invented footwork, but his footwork was invented at a time when pads are just becoming normal, right?
Yeah.
And so he's still thinking of his pads as just that. Then we start to see batters use Grace's footwork with the pads side by side. And Grace was one of those, by the way, who did that. And then Arthur Shrewsbury comes in and goes, why am I even trying to hit these balls when I can use my pads as an actual proper line of defense? If I don't want to hit this ball, I can just pad it away. So if the ball was, I'm trying to remember the exact law when Shrewsbury played it, but it would have been if the ball wasn't pitched in line and hitting the stumps, you couldn't have been out LBW. I think that would have been the law during his time. And so the minute he sees the ball pitched outside off stump or leg stump, he can pad up to anything he wants. So he's literally getting you to bowl to him exactly as he wants you to bowl to him at that point. And so it then becomes, pad play becomes a really important part of cricket.
Hmm.
Probably, what would we say, maybe late 1800s?
Yeah,
Through the early 1900s, I think is the period where it becomes really important. And then, of course, that's when we start to tamper with the LBW law quite a bit.
Yeah.
And the LBW law every couple of years gets, and that's just purely because batters are so good at using their pads at that point. And so you have to keep changing what you are doing with the laws in order to catch up with players. The same way that we're now talking about if you play a reverse sweep or a switch hit, there is a possibility in the future you won't have pitched outside leg stump anymore, right?
True.
Or hitting outside off stump, because I'm sorry, you guys have taken away what your off and leg stump are. You just have to deal with that. That might be the law. That will come in the same way that Shrewsbury changed the law and that other great players in the 1920s and 30s changed the laws.
And I mean, batters did what Shrewsbury did for the longest time, right? Like at least on the leg side, we saw people in the early 2000s also pad the ball away. So that's a major, kind of a point in cricket history or batting history as well. But here's what really fascinated me, Jared. This is probably my favorite bit from the chapter. I had no clue that in the 19th century, batters would either play straight or on the offside and only hit on the leg side when they really absolutely had to. And it was even kind of considered impolite to hit on the leg side. Like W.G. Grace had all the shots in the world, but on the leg side, he would be like a nervous snudger, right? And that changes with Ranji. And those of you people who do not know Ranji, he was the Nawab of Nawanagar. His full name was H.H. Shri Sir Ranji Singhji Vibhaji. And the Ranji Trophy is named after him, of course. And he was afraid of the ball, right? So his coach, Dan Hayward, who was the brother of Tom Hayward, who was also another cricketer, a really good cricketer of his time.
Great batter himself.
Yeah. Dan Hayward ties Ranji's leg or right leg to the ground. And now Ranji is batting and he just, you know, organically invents the leg glance. And that's pretty much the first time batters start intentionally hitting the ball on the leg side. And I just feel like this is insane. And I told my wife this story and she was shocked that after all of this, the Maharaja goes on to play 15 test matches for England and never gets to play for India.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really weird. And it comes down to classism, right? And
it cultural. Does.
So Ranji's an outsider, you know, in many ways. And as you said, he has this weird coach. We still don't know whether it was a bucket he was tied to or a brick. Like there are many different stories of it. Chances are it was both, right? I think Hayward was just trying to say to him, you can't bat if you're backing away, which we all know to be true, like as a general rule. That's why tail enders do it and top order players don't do it, right?
Yeah.
If you're backing away, your head is moving and you're exposing your stumps. So it comes from that. But the interesting thing, as you said, is that especially amateur cricketers were terrified of like playing what would have been kind of considered ungrammatical shots, right? Which are slogs and flicks and all the normal shots that people play now. Yeah. And so you had fielders on the leg side. I don't want to say there was no one on the leg side. You had fielders on the leg side, but you had fielders on the leg side for when your bowler bowled down the leg side. Because there, in those days, you tried to bowl at the stumps, right? So you're trying to bowl someone or get them out LBW. Slips weren't as big a deal back then. The bowlers weren't quick enough to carry. The pitches weren't as good. So you're literally trying to get people out bowled in LBW over and over again. And of course, that means you're going to slip the odd ball down. So, you know, traditionally, you might even have a fielder behind the wicketkeeper. But if not, you would have a fine leg rather, you know, in a very fine position. You would probably have someone at square leg as well for, again, the one that's slipping down. And then you might have someone at mid-wicket. In that position in case the ball is hit there accidentally. Because the balls were still hit there. You can't, you might not have been trying to do it on purpose, Behram, but you're still going to hit the ball to the leg side.
Yeah.
And so what Ranji really does, as you say, is by standing in that position, his way of protecting himself, remember, he's afraid of the ball, is to flick the ball off his pads, which is now going not to very fine leg, right, is now going to sort of more deep backward square leg or where a sort of traditional fine leg fielder would be or long leg, however you want to look at those positions, right? So it's going square on the field and he opens up that as a style. There's another brief shot that comes in, which is called the draw shot.
I read about
which it. Which again is trying to get the ball to fine leg, but from off stump. But essentially what was happening is it was bowlers cramping up left-handers and they were doing it or in-swing bowlers. And so you would flick the ball back between the sides. It's we talk about the nutmeg and Steve Smith playing that shot. Yeah. I think they are doing it from a power base, whereas these guys were just sort of flicking it back. And then the next big jump, of course, is just after Ranji is Trumper, who does exactly what Ranji does. But the difference is that he hits the ball to mid-on, to mid-wicket, to square leg, and to fine leg, which means that cricket changes forever right there. And from that point onwards, we start to use the entire field.
It's interesting, right? So if you look at the leg glance as a shot, you can see how someone who pioneered it might have been scared of the ball, right? Like you can literally just picture all of that and then... This might come across as a mad conspiracy theory, Jared, but considering that Ranji was from the subcontinent, is that why Asian players are more risky? Because the non-Asian players were not playing that shot at all prior? Muscle memory?
I mean, if you think about it, I actually find it really fascinating. So I've been working on Eek's batting recently quite a lot, and you will know this. Anyone who's ever played a decent level of cricket will kind of understand this, that there's... When the ball's on your pads, your first instinct, right, is to flick it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what you should be doing, of course, is not flicking it. What you should be doing is getting your foot out of the way and drilling it to mid-on or wide of mid-on, right? That's the proper shot. almost no cricketers do this. Right? Yeah. Like that's why the on drive is such a rare shot in cricket, because people are playing across their pad and they're flicking away, which is why bowling straight at middle and leg stump gets you lots of bolts and LBWs, because people are playing the wrong shot. And so in Asia, I don't think that Asian people have, you could argue that they have different kinds of wrists because of genetics and everything else. And Murali can put his hand back until it touches his arm, right? Like, that might be that. But I don't think they play those shots because of their wrists. I think they play those shots because of the wickets and the slow nature of the wickets when the ball, it's very hard to be a wristy player in Australia just because the ball comes on so quick.
True. And it comes at a good bounce, whereas the bounce of the subcontinent is quite low, so you can flick it.
So it's slower and lower, and you can kind of flick your hands across it like a tennis player more, right? There's a possibility that that is what it was. There is a possibility that Asian people just have different kinds of wrists because of, you know, evolution or, you know, I have no idea. I've never done it. I always thought that it was a bit of a racist thing to just say Asian players are wristy, because not all Asian players are wristy to begin with. And it's a bit of a cop-out. And Mark Waugh was wristy as anything, right? You know, there have been plenty of players from other cultures that have been wristy as well. But I do think there is an element of that. But as you say, I think if Ranji had the exact same issue and he was an English player, he would have got his foot out of the line and drilled it up towards mid-on or straight, which means that it wouldn't have revolutionized the game. Yeah. The revolutionary bit was that he was taking a ball from middle and leg stump and turning it all the way out on the leg side, and now you've opened up the field completely. Yeah. So the fact that Ranji was Asian, or the fact that he had wrists like that or whatever it may be, and he had bad footwork, all of those three things came together to make him into a player who is very important for the future of the game.
Yeah, and of course, with the leg glance, of course, I mean, we see Trumper, who makes leg side play more mainstream thereon. But, you know, it does open up an entire area which was unknown before that, and I feel like that's why Ranji is important. But then again, he was flicking it, right? Or playing the leg glance. Whereas when you look at Trumper, he makes cross-batted shots more repeatable when they are bowled straight to him, or even at times when they are bowled outside off. And this is like very, very new to cricket. No one's ever done this before. It kind of happens around the same time. So Ranji ends his career in the early 1900s, and that's also when Trumper is playing, right? I don't know if those careers overlap or not.
There's a slight overlap in their careers, but basically, Ranji is the best player in the batter in the world, and then Trumper becomes the best batter in the world, sort of back to back.
Yeah, Ranji averaged 45 with the bat in his 15 test matches for England, and Trumper in his career, I think he played 40 test matches and averaged 39. Now, he was an opener, so you can kind of understand how 39 might be better, but what he really did was that not only did he change batting by hitting those repeatable cross-batted shots, Jared, but also he kind of disrupts bowling in a way where now all these bowlers are targeting that channel outside off stump. And weirdly, this channel has defensive roots. Like, who would have thought, right? It's supposed to be attacking in the modern day.
Yeah, it's so weird, isn't it? That it's Trump is the first guy that we really know this is true of, that they stop bowling at the stumps to him and they start bowling outside off stump. It doesn't stop him, by the way. He just keeps playing the same shots. He just learns how to play them from outside off stump. But they are trying to slow him down by being, you know, bowling in that channel and controlling the game and everything. And it's considered a hugely defensive thing. It's funny that you see it as attacking, because even it was called, in Australia, it was called the Queensland line. Uh-huh. And that was seen as a derogatory term for bowling too wide of the off stump. Mm-hmm. And England's the place where it's seen as attacking. Australia and South Africa, it's seen as conservative cricket. But but it was definitely 100% seen as conservative at that time. And so Trumper's ability to open up the field, and it means that, like modern cricket, like if I'm bowling six balls to you just outside off stump and you've got eight fielders on the offside, we know what's going to happen. I'm either going to shuffle across, or I'm going to take a middle or an off stump guard and just block one on the leg side and take a single and get off. And Trumper was basically the guy that sort of starts that, but he does it in an aggressive, flamboyant way. And as you said, it's the repeatable nature. We had I don't want to pretend like he was the first big hitter in cricket, and I don't want to pretend like he was the first fast scorer in cricket, but he did it in a way that really he shouldn't have averaged 39, right? Like, he was taking massive risks in an era where no one did it, and the pitches are only just starting to get good. It's not as if he was batting in the 1920s or 1930s, he probably averages closer to 50. right, doing the same thing. Yeah. But to be able to average 40 in the era that he does is still quite remarkable.
So,
and then you've got his strike rate, which is that's the other big boom, right? Because now batters can score quick.
Yes, but it's interesting how, you know, he might not be cricket's first Mad Max, but he is probably cricket's first effective Mad Max, because he's averaging 39, batting the way he is, playing those aggressive cross-batted shots repeatedly, and he's altering the lines of the bowlers. They're, you know, forced to think. You're also manipulating the field. All of a sudden, captains are thinking, okay, I need more fielders in that region. And then, you know, ultimately, this also brings about that law change where you can't have two fielders or more than two fielders on the leg side behind a square.
Mate, I hadn't even thought about that. That's a perfect... You're right, because... traditionally, there would have been no reason to have two leg slips, right? There would have been no reason to have a leg slip, a leg gully, a fine leg, a deep backward square. It just wouldn't have made any sense. But once Trumper opens that up, you have the ability to do that. And now you have to slow batters down. So in the old days, to slow batters down, you're just bowling the best line that you can, and you've set your field. And yes, you might get, I don't know, let's say someone like a Gilbert Jessop or Sinclair from South Africa, right? You might get the odd guy like that who can whack it back over the heads and everything, but you don't get many players like that. Whereas now, by the mid-1900s, everyone's doing that. And by the time Jack Hobbs and Sutcliffe and Bradman and all that there, they're using, like, you watch Bradman play, just have a look at his eyes. He is just looking for gaps all the time in a way a modern player would. That is not how traditional players would play. They would get the ball and they would play the right shot.
Yeah.
That's the right shot. It was on off stump. It was full. So I drove it to mid off. Next one is on off stump. He's outside off stump and is on a length. I push that into covers, right? Like, they're playing the right shots over and over again. By the time you get to Bradman, he's not playing the right shots anymore. He's playing the shot that is going to work for that field, right? Yeah. And you have a look at the bat angle. And, you know, him shuffling across the crease, you know, giving himself room to guide the ball through, through backward point, all these different shots. That's what Trumper opens up, which is the fact that now a modern player, you've watched Azhar Ali, right? Like, Azhar Ali is a fantastic player, but you could tell that Azhar Ali was someone who was late to batting because he would play the same shot to mid off five times in a row, right? Whereas if you look at someone who is a natural batter from a young age, they're trying to get to the left hand of mid-off, right? They're trying to get between the mid-off and the bowler. Whereas Azhar Ali, still a fantastic, no one's saying he wasn't a fantastic batter, because he has a ridiculous record for someone who has his background. But you could see the difference. And if you look at, I'm trying to think of, Lara is maybe one of the best examples of that. I'm trying to think of someone a little bit more modern of Root. Root is a perfect example of this. Bowl the same ball to Root six times in a row, and if you've got a gap at backward point, he'll hit the backward point. Put the fielder in at backward point, and he hits it in front of point. Put the fielder in at point, but take the cover away, he finds the cover gap. Then he'll look to hit straight or to mid-wicket. Like, he's constantly looking for that gap with his hands. None of that exists before Trumper. It wasn't even, you just played the shot, and it's like, oh, they've got a cover and an extra cover. How am I going to get through this? I'm going to have to hit it harder, right? Whereas now, that's not how batters think. They're like, either they're going to go over or they're going to find the other gap.
So yeah, Ranji and Trumper, they open up leg side play in two very different ways. And that then changes batting forever towards the turn of the 20th century. You know, the 19th century is ending. But there's more I want to talk to you about Trumper. However, we have to take a break. Before that, you guys are watching Footmarks with Bairam and Jared, and we'll be back in like half a minute. So go nowhere.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN.
Welcome back to Footmarks. You guys are with Jared and Bairam. And we started our conversation on 19th century batting with the evolution of bowling, weirdly, underarm to roundarm to overarm. Then how the muck spreader changed the surface and made it more, or made cricket more batting friendly. And then, of course, WG Grace deploying both front foot and back foot shots. That was the early days. And then Ranji and Trumper open up leg side play. They alter what lengths bowlers are bowling at, where captains are placing their fielders. And of course, some field change laws as well, as we just spoke about. Mm. However, considering Jared, even WG Grace didn't have strong leg side play, and before Ranji and Trumper, no one really kind of masters that art. I just wanted to ask you, I was curious, is Trumper then by default the pioneer of the pull slash hook shot?
No, because again, that's a shot that you play if the ball is at your body to get the ball off your body.
Ah.
What Trumper would have done then is, because Gilbert Jessop is someone who's like, and he played, he's probably about 5-6 years before Trump. Gilbert Jessop is like the first Trumper prototype in terms of scoring fast.
Uh-huh.
And there's plenty of stories about Trumper playing the pull and the hook. But you're playing the pull and the hook then because the ball's at your body and like you can't get away. And so you're playing those shots, right? What we're talking about with Trumper is he might play the pull shot when it's wide outside a stump.
True.
Right. So that's a very different thing. So people were still hitting the ball to leg, but they were only hitting the ball to leg when there's like, if you've ever had anyone bowl down the leg side, it's actually very hard to hit the ball to off stump.
Yeah.
Right. Like unless you're, you know, VVS Laxman, it's very hard to hit it to the offside once it's bowled down the leg side. So people were still doing that because bowlers were still making mistakes. Trumper's thing is that he's taking good balls and taking them over there.
Hmm. And which is quite common now. You see a lot of batters smash a ball which is bowled outside off stump up and over cow corner, right? Like it's not like an anomaly. You will see it in T20 cricket every time you tune in, basically. But here's another interesting anecdote from the chapter that I was really curious about. You mentioned how two guys from the past, and when I say past, I mean like maybe perhaps even the mid-19th century, in William Yardley and Walter Reed, they play some early version of the switch hit, but it doesn't quite, you know, carry on. What's that story all about?
Yeah, so I mean, we don't know the full details. Hmm. What we know is that they played shots. I think they were both right-handers off the top of my head. And they played shots that were left-handed shots. Did they make the decision before the ball was bowled? Hmm. Or did they make the decision after the ball was bowled? We don't know. It's very possible that they actually faced up left-handed. And that's what it was at that stage, which is, again, the field is set for a right-hander and I'm going to face left-handed and do that. It's very clear, though, that it doesn't take off and that it isn't particularly seen as something that should be done. Hmm. So, you know, being that this is an episode about old cricket, the first registered overarm delivery or roundarm delivery is actually in the 1700s.
Oh.
But it doesn't become, there's the whole story about women inventing overarm bowling. They didn't. Sadly, that story is completely false. And we could do another podcast on that. Women actually invented cricket. They don't need to invent overarm bowling. They invented the entire sport, but that's a whole different thing. But the first roundarm ball is actually at Hambledon in the late 1700s. But it's not done again. I would say that Reed's shot is probably something similar where he did it and he probably got a little bit of flack for it at the time. Hmm. And or maybe it didn't work is the other option there. And so he doesn't really go on to do it again. He was obviously a fantastic player in his era as well. But you've got to remember that there was actually quite a bit of, like we just talked about the draw shot. That's an experimental shot, right? Bowlers are changing. And so I would assume that during Reed's career, when does he make his debut? He makes his debut in 1873. So that's pre muck spreaders making a big impact on the game, right?
Yeah.
And he finishes in 1897. So one of the other things that happens then, we haven't even talked about this, is swing bowling and spin bowling.
Yes.
Right? So there was always an element of spin bowling because if you throw underarm, it's quite easy to put revolutions on the ball. But overarm spin bowling, as we now understand it, is coming through. So there's a chance that someone like Reed, who's an older cricketer, who's trying to work his way through all this, is thinking, well, wait a minute, I can't play this right-handed, but maybe I can play it left-handed, and then maybe it doesn't work. But yeah, there's definitely that element of that. And I think that had cricket been more, I don't want to say multicultural because that's the wrong way of putting it, but more international. I think you would have had more people trying more things in different countries.
More diverse, right? Maybe diverse is the word you're looking for.
Whereas it's monoculture, right? Hmm. So Fred Offuth, who basically invents swing bowling, right? Or certainly perfects the first version of swing bowling. Mm-hmm. He grew up as an underarm bowler in Australia, sees the English come over learned, teaches himself over arm bowling, watching them play. Mm. And because he's different to everyone else, he kind of teaches himself swing bowling by accident, right?
Yeah.
So just one person from another culture in a different country invents swing bowling, whereas England could have done that, right?
But there's also the American, isn't there, who was a really good swing bowler. I've forgotten his
Barton
name.
King, yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
So he's early 1900s. And again, Fred Spofforth and Barton King are both using baseball methods as well as cricket methods. So they're combining the two. So again, and these are still essentially English people in many different ways, right? Like I think Spofforth might have even been born in England. But being in those other cultures and being exposed to other sports allows them to bring things in. So I think that we would have seen more things like that. Like, I don't think it's a surprise that the reverse sweep comes out of somewhere like Pakistan, right? Mm. Because again, it's a different cricket culture that thinks of things differently. Leary Constantine apparently played a shot similar to a scoop at one stage, right? So we know that other cricket cultures are doing that. Whereas in England, it's a very predominant cricket culture. And then you're having to fit into the establishment as well. Mm. So it's like an establishment on top of an establishment within English cricket. So when we had a pioneer, like I think it was Tom Walker was the guy who first bowled overarm, they were just like, no.
Yeah.
No, well, that's not how we play cricket.
It was like a private men's club, right? You know what happened with Bozinkay? They wanted to ban the googly, right? The wrong one. And there are many instances of just the administration fighting back whenever there's some sort of change in cricket. And that probably comes from that whole imperial mindset where it has to be textbook and we will not have anything else. Like, that's what I assume it was. But it's interesting how, sure, the draw shot and the early versions of the switch hit, they don't kind of stick around. Maybe that's because they're not repeatable. Maybe it's just because cricket wasn't diverse enough. But post Ranji and Trumper, there is a lull in cricket. There's obviously also like a world war, which halts cricket. But you don't really see any innovation in batting up until the 1960s when the reverse sweep is introduced by the Muhammad brothers, Hanif and Mushtaq. And it's weird how, it's very relatable how batting has evolved. Because at first you get some very rudimentary stuff, right? Which, now that you think of it, is the first thing you teach to a kid, right? You can play both front foot and back foot shots, yada, yada, yada. And then, all of a sudden, post-1960, right? As soon as reverse sweep happens, it's just exponential. Cricket goes mad thereon, and cricket batting in the 20th century, it just evolves at a much faster rate, which is kind of like technology overall, if you think about it.
Yeah, I think what happens is between Trumper and Bradman, right? What you get is the perfection of the technique.
Uh-huh.
Right? So Trumper is not a perfect player. Grace was not a perfect player. Ranji was not a perfect player. Hobbs is the guy that is almost the link between that era and Bradman's era.
Yeah.
And Hobbs is ridiculous, right? 197, 199 first class hundreds. Just absolutely goes on to boss the game incredibly. And so that is, I think, them learning how to perfect batting. And remember, they're learning how to bat on these new pitches for the first time.
True.
Right? As in, even in Trumper's era, you still had, they were still working through wickets and everything. There aren't that many people. Like, Trumper averages 39. Everything after Trumper's era, 39 is not an acceptable average. But in his era, it was still a really, really good average to have, right?
Yeah.
There weren't, other than Hobbs, there weren't really many players averaging much more than 40, right, at that point. So I think it's a perfection of batting. Then once you've perfected that style of batting, that's when the global game really comes in, right?
Yeah.
And it's the global game, which is, Pakistan bringing in reverse sweeps. Then it's also limited overs games, right? So running between the wickets, it becomes a big deal. Playing the reverse sweep, premeditating shots, moving your position on the crease. All of these things come in all, one after the other, because Bradman's style has already been perfected. Hutton, you know what that period is?
This little era that you speak of where they were perfecting the technique, it's the VCR or VHS tape era. We had them for eons. And then all of a sudden you went to VCDs, DVDs, thumb drives, and now you're just in a streaming service era, right? Like, it continues to get wider.
Yeah, so you go from Hobbs through to Hutton, and like, Hutton is just exactly what test match technique is supposed to be, right? Uh-huh. He's not even like Bradman. Even Bradman is a bit of an outlier, and Headley's a bit of an outlier, whereas Hutton is just high front elbow, making the right decisions, doing all that sort of stuff, all the way through to Sachin. All Sachin really adds to it is, the ability to whip the ball a little bit more off the line. Bradman is just an extension and a slightly more powerful version of what Hutton is. But outside of those guys is, as you say, is the all the different high definition discs that we had all the way through.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sobers is a power player, right? Then you start to get, again, you start to get people who loft the ball in the air, which again, wasn't that common. People made a decision to hit the ball in the air. So you start to get all that sort of stuff. Then you get the back foot players.
True.
And why do we have back foot players? That's because now we're getting short balls and bouncers bowled more. Then you get the helmet players, right? Guys who've grown up with helmets. So you keep adding little bits to that, you know, and you have Lara is a bit of an outlier and a disruptor. And AB de Villiers is a bit of an outlier and a disruptor. And Steve Smith is, right? You still get your Tendulkars and Huttons, like Callis, right? You still get those players that come through, but then you get these other players who stretch the game in a slightly different, you know, everyone starts batting on off stump because of Steve Smith, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a global phenomenon that has happened because one guy is basically walking across his stumps to play the ball. And so those disruptors keep coming, and they come every couple of years, right? Like,
but also,
you know, Viv Richards,
I feel
Kevin
like
Peterson.
You get these disruptors, of course, but there is a role to play in the overall evolution of the sport, not just batting, right? I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that happens post-reverse sweep in the 1960s, right? Limited overs cricket happens, and it becomes mainstream a little later on, and that's when you get more aggressive batting and, you know, better fielding, better running between the wickets, all of that stuff happens. And then if you go back to the period in the late 90s, or well, the mid 90s, where all wickets get covered, you know, finger spin dies in certain areas, that impacts cricket a lot. The West Indian pace bowling quartet of the late 70s and 80s, that alters the length, and now you need to be a different kind of batter to succeed. And then Pakistan fast bowlers bring in reverse swing. And then you think of, you know, TV money coming in, and DRS and Hawkeye coming in, and all of a sudden T20 cricket is here, and you have to evolve at a more rapid pace now. You are forced to evolve at a more rapid pace. Anything else is not an option. Yeah.
No, exactly. And I think it's also everything you just mentioned, but also culture.
Yes.
Right? Rashid Khan has been inspired by Shahid Afridi, but he also didn't have the same level of cricket coaching of Shahid Afridi.
Yeah.
So Shahid Afridi's bowling is still tethered to traditional cricket thinking, right?
Yep.
Rashid Khan is watching on YouTube and watching clips online, and he doesn't have a coach there to tell him that that's the wrong way to hold the ball. Right? True. And so Rashid Khan is, it's a bit like the Pixies are trying to be the Beatles, but they invent grunge music by accident, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't know the exact structure. And so their structure is this, and they do it this way. And then someone goes, oh, you're a pioneer. And they're like, are we? We thought we were the Beatles, right? And so that's what happens when you bring in other cultures and you bring in other thinking and, you know, diverse groups, you get that sort of thing. The same with the reverse swing and all these different, you know, like little things that have happened. The wobble ball, right? Wobble ball is a perfect example of, again, of something like that happening. So once you open cricket up to this big thing, all these different cultures are going to come in, and we're going to see more and more of that, right?
Yeah.
You know, Australia brings running between the wickets. Yeah. South Africa brought in playing off spin by shuffling outside off stump. Like, you know, little things like that are predominant in culture. We had them in the 1800s and 1900s, but it happened slowly. And as you say, now you can get a whole thing take over. And then we were getting them in countries before now. Now, because of franchise cricket, you know, Peter Siddle learns the wobble ball because he's playing for Essex, right?
Yeah.
You know, the back of the hand slower ball was an Australian thing that wasn't that popular outside of cricket. Most cultures have like a guy who can bowl the back of the hand slower ball. Andrew Tai and Benny Howell are bowling the knuckleball again. The knuckleball had existed beforehand. Zahir Khan had bowled it. Adam Holyoke had bowled it. But the difference is now that it's spreading really quickly.
Yes.
And so, you know, you get the best of that. You know, it's fascinating to see how quickly these things change. And women will be the next bring in innovations, right?
Absolutely.
But, you know, I've always thought that women's basketball is, from a fundamental point of view, much more interesting because they have to do everything fundamentally right, because they can't just do, you know, three jab steps, get around their player, and then dunk over four people, right? Like, they can't do that. So women's basketball and European basketball are much more intellectual than the NBA because it's more like chess, right?
Yeah.
And because of that, that is where the NBA coaches went to find their new strategies, right?
It's really fascinating, when you think about all of this evolution, maybe VHS tapes wasn't a perfect analogy. Maybe telephones are better, right? Because they kind of overlap perfectly with the cricket or the batting innovations.
Yeah.
It's the telegram or whatever the hell they had in those 1800s days, and you have some very major changes, which brings about the cord phone, right? The one in which you go swipe, 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 and then you ring up someone. Yeah. That also kind of probably happens in the early 1900s, right? And we don't see any evolution in it for the longest time. And then, of course, technology advances so much that you literally went from those big-ass mobile phones to these very convenient computers in your hand, which are smartphones. So it's interesting how, you know, modern-day T20 cricket or white ball cricket has erupted. Now you get your Abhishek Sharmas and Fraser McGurks and players off that mold, Web of Suryavanshi, who just want to go out there and smash it. And that's, we're basically at the precipice of that becoming the norm, I feel. So are we like going to be stuck in the smartphone era a bit, like where the next best batter is just a modified camera on the phone, right? Because we have kind of gotten there as far as smartphones are concerned.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, until Elon Musk puts a chip in that dude's head,
yeah.
And then it'll end up there. But
of course.
I'm working on a piece which is kind of, it's actually quite similar to what we were talking about today, which is a little bit based on all the evolution of cricket so far, but is also based on T20 cricket specifically.
Hmm.
If you look at cricket, there's this great story. I was telling you on someone else's podcast the other day, but I think scientists are a little bit unsure on whether this is true or not. But you know what a Triceratops is, and you know what a T-Rex is.
Uh-huh.
But they're like the final format of those two formats of dinosaurs, right?
Yep.
I won't go through the full names, but if you look them up, they've got scientific names and they're part of a family that basically the T-Rex is the alpha version of that and the Triceratops is the alpha version of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the part of America that those two dinosaurs were involved, if you go through, there was always a big predator that was a little bit like a T-Rex.
Uh-huh.
And there was a herbivore that had armor on it around its face or horns around its face like the Triceratops. And every couple of years, we'd have a new version of the Triceratops and we'd have a new version of... And so that is where we're at. We never know when we're going to get to that sort of peak Triceratops versus T-Rex point. There were probably evolutions where the T-Rex evolved, but it worked for a little while and didn't work that long, so they had to evolve again. There were probably versions of the T-Rex, you know, and the Allosaurus, or actually, I'm not sure the Allosaurus is one of them, but there's a bunch of them where it was different. Right? And it didn't work perfectly well. The only thing that we know is that there are going to be periods where we probably don't have, as you say, we're just putting phones, better phones on the cameras.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's on the phone. Sorry.
Better cameras on the phones. That's basically where we are at today.
And then suddenly we have a 3D imagery in front of us,
like
right?
A hologram sort of thing. Like we're doing this with you sitting right in front of me.
Exactly. That might be the next step.
Yeah.
We don't know where we are with batting at the moment, I think it's fair. But because of T20 cricket, I would say that we're probably in a faster developing zone than we've ever been in before, because there wasn't actually a financial reason for Victor Trumper to score quickly.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
He just did. He just found cricket so easy.
Also,
and he thought about it in a different way that he scored in the way that he did.
To that note, there was no financial reason for Arthur Shrewsbury to not pad the ball away. In fact, it was the opposite. He had to stick around longer, right?
Exactly. And so it's sort of a haphazard development in cricket at that point.
Yeah.
It's not haphazard anymore.
Mm.
If you can score, if you can hit a boundary every three balls, right? Even if it's a late career thing like Heinrich Klassen, you go from being worth $150,000 a year to $5 million a year.
True.
Right? So if that's the case, we should be in another rapid development phase at the moment. The issue is that we just had a huge development phase because Tilakaratne Dilshan and Ryan Campbell and Douglas Murillier just invented a new scoring zone on the ground.
Yes.
Right? So we've got that, and we've also got the history of, and you know, it's something else that I really like, but the history of premeditated shots, because that has changed cricket. We basically, even in Trumper's day, we didn't have premeditated shots. Now we have premeditated shots, as in you need to change your technique or your style in order to play it. We've just had that, right? Because you talk about the reverse sweep in the 60s with the Muhammad brothers, it's not really popular until the 90s, right? Yeah. Then but because of the reverse sweep, you have the switch hit, you then have the scoop, and the, you know, all these different other versions of all those shots.
And now you have like 10,000 different versions of the ramp, right? It's not even
exactly
unilateral.
Exactly. And now it's a natural shot, whereas before it wasn't as natural a shot. So we just had that huge evolution.
Yeah.
So does that mean that there isn't anywhere else to go? That's the thing that you or I are not going to be able to do. It's going to be some kid in some random backyard. You know, so it might be some girl who can't play shots like her, you know, her brothers or her cousins or her neighbors because she's too small, and she comes up with a new way of doing it. It's going to be some kid from like Uganda who saw cricket on the TV one day because they're in the World Cup and has looked at some YouTube highlights and he's misunderstood what a coach is saying on a YouTube video. And do you know what I mean? Like, we don't even know where that next generation will find their inspiration from. It'll be some failed baseballer who's like, oh, I couldn't play baseball, but maybe if I combine this from baseball, or an ice hockey player, yeah. Right? It's going to be something like that that just sort of springs up from this random thing. And, you know, Trumper comes so randomly into cricket, right? Great batting was generally thought to be the English way, and suddenly Ranji and Trumper just completely flipped that, right? No, I don't think anyone could have predicted that that was about to happen. So I don't know what you would predict next, but my guess is that it is going to be for some random outlier who comes at it from a completely different angle. You know, I mean, one last point in all this is Josh Butler. The way he hits the ball is not the way that people used to hit sixes.
Yeah.
Right? And it's because of his multi-sport background that allowed him to grip the bat slightly differently. And so instead of having the big high front elbow and the big forward step through the ball, he's hitting it more like an ice hockey or a golf player.
Yeah.
Right. And that is a much more repeatable way of hitting sixes than trying to be, you know, Freddie Flintoff or Jack Skellis and get the big front leg down and swing through the ball. So we're already, those sorts of things will happen. And maybe Butler can't even fully explain how he's been able to do that, right? And that's the next level.
Yeah, I suppose in conclusion, we can say that batting is in its smartphone era, but we don't know what the batting equivalent would be of the Elon chip in the human head, I suppose. That's the one thing.
I hope we don't ever get to the chip in the heads of batting.
But you get the drift, right? What will be that next level? Yeah. We can't tell. Even with technology, we just have a few guesses. But with batting, I think it's even more unknown because it could go like anywhere. And we have exploited all the different areas on the ground. But anyway, that kind of wraps up this conversation. It's gone way longer than I thought it would, but it's been a fun chat, Jared. I hope you guys enjoyed it as well. And let us know how you feel about the evolution of batting by Jared's book, of course, as well, The Art of Batting.
I've got an announcement. I don't know if I've said it yet, but the printed version in India is going to be available from the 23rd of June. I haven't heard from other countries. I did hear August for Australia, and obviously for everyone else, they'll have to wait a little bit longer. But we're getting there. We're pushing it. The more people who buy it in England and India, the more places it will be published around the world.
Absolutely. So go get your copies today and leave us all of your thoughts with respect to today's subject matter in the comments section below. Also, just a quick reminder, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage, which can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the fun work we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll see you soon enough on another live or a quick picks or something, but that's all for today, folks. Have a good one and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.